Welcome back to The Daily Drum on WHUR, Sirius XM Channel 141, 96.3 HD2 and 98.3 FM. This is the Insight segment. I'm Harold Fisher. Recreational marijuana has been legal in the state of Maryland for less than 2 weeks. But in some ways, we're already seeing the impact. The first weekend saw more than $10 million in sales at dispensaries. And while the first round of new licenses for recreational sales did not prioritize minorities, the next round will give preferences to minority owners. Well, tonight we are talking about what legalization of recreational marijuana means for the state of Maryland. My guests are Jamal Waith, brand developer for Bouquet Rolling Papers, and Maryland District 28 Delegate C.T. Wilson in Charles County. He is also chair of the House Economic Matters Committee. And you, the listener. Lines are open at 202-319-7810. 202-319-7810. Lines are open. As I said, you can also tweet me at H Fisher, WHUR, or find me on Instagram at Harold T. Fisher. Jamal, good to see you again. Thanks for joining the conversation.
Likewise. Appreciate
and it. Delegate Wilson, good to talk to you as well. Thank you so much for joining us.
Definitely my pleasure. Thank you.
So I'm going to start with you. Here we are. We are, you know, Maryland is on its way in the legal recreational marijuana space. Of course, you as chair of the House Economic Matters Committee were a pivotal political voice in making sure that this happened. Just kind of give me your impressions of where we are now since July 1st.
Well, this is something, obviously, I didn't decide. I actually wasn't a huge fan of the cannabis industry. However, not only my constituents, but the entire state decided, I think it's roughly 6-7% of the people decided to, you know, to vote for this to legalize. And I will say that I think it's very important to realize that my goal was not about getting Marylanders high, but to stop young black men from being arrested and being murdered for, you know, this marijuana. And I've got, as a defense attorney, I got three left have three homicide cases that are all cannabis related. And so that's just, it's beyond time. And while I'm not a fan of the substance, I do understand the needs and what my citizens have decided to push through. It became incumbent upon me to make sure we drafted the business side of it to where it could actually impact my community the best, because we know we're going to receive the detriment as we always have.
I want to talk about that first point that you made. Do you believe that the legalization will positively impact the criminal use of marijuana in Maryland? And this is why I ask you. Before he retired, I had a conversation with D.C. Police Chief Robert Conti, and he said that even though recreational marijuana is legal in D.C., they were still seeing crimes related to the sale and distribution of marijuana in D.C., and in some cases, homicides. So he did not believe, and this was pre-pandemic, but he said that he did not believe that the legalization of recreational marijuana in D.C. would impact, for example, gun violence and the like.
Well, again, I'm not sure his understanding. I've been in doing criminal defense work and prosecution for 25 years. And what I understood is, in D.C. especially, they created demand by legalizing, but they did not have a proper market set up so people couldn't access it. As such, people that were in the illicit market were still going to make money. My goal in Maryland was to set it up in such a way where it was, you know, I kept the taxes as low as possible, 9%, which is what our liquor tax is, to make it accessible to where there are enough of the market around the entire state so people don't have to go on a street corner, and also to guarantee safety through our, health and welfare and our inspection. So the goal really is to drive people off of the street corner, not the people that want to sell it, but the people that they would sell to. And of course, you will still have your people that stick to it. But I talked to a young man at my law firm yesterday, and he said that the marijuana he was able to buy at the dispensary was significantly cheaper than what he's used to buying on the street. And that's my goal, because unlike many other states, D.C. included, they try to make it a cash cow. And they try to, you know, tax it very high. But in doing so, you drive up the cost. Ergo, you create a desire, you create a demand, but then it's cheaper to go on the street. My goal was not to do that, which is why we kept it at 9% tax, to make sure that we drive people towards the legal market. Mm-hmm. So I don't believe he's correct. I believe it's how it's set up, the business of it. And in fact, this is a business, is what we've decided. So to make this a legitimate market, you have to make it affordable. You have to make it accessible, and you have to make it safe. We have done those things.
Jamal, you were nodding when he said that the District of Columbia did not have this set up. Share your thoughts with me.
I honestly believe that's always been one of the negative downfalls, definitely with the legalization of marijuana in D.C., is there's the gray area. We don't know these stores, like, honestly, you know, they're not dispensaries. They're just, you know, you can come in and get some stuff. So I've necessarily haven't been a huge fan of them. I do see the need, especially since there were a lot of places where, again, there, like we were talking about before, there are a lot of places where people that look like us are not always welcome or feel safe to go in. So these places do serve a need, you know, with the public as well. But we don't, you know, there's too much of a gray area in D.C. for it to be the model of any place. Specifically, I would think.
We're joined now by Martin Mitchell, at-large council member for the city of Laurel, Maryland. Council member, thank you so much for joining the conversation.
Welcome. Pleasure to be here. You didn't mention they called me the cannabis councilman as well.
Oh, see, I didn't know that. now I do. Okay, so I'll ask you the same question that I asked Delegate Wilson. 10 days in from the legalization of recreational marijuana in Maryland. From your perspective, where are we? Are you happy with the way things are looking? Do you have concerns? What?
So, you know, Delegate Wilson, appreciate him, of course, for passing this bill, championing his effort. I've seen him a lot of times when we were on the Question 4 trail, letting people know about this. My biggest thing has been making sure that the people who have been incarcerated, you know, come out of jail. The people who have been sentenced, you know, or resentenced, and making sure that we have expungements. I know that we went some way on expungements. As far as business, you know, business is booming. We saw it. I think it was in the first weekend they did
more than 10 million.
Yeah, it was like 10.5. To the point, I would say that, you know, what I can see, the pricing is about fair to street pricing, but you can definitely still probably get some cheaper things on the street, you know, just to be fair. I do appreciate having the business aspect, because I've always been a medical patient for a long time. So I appreciate having that business aspect, because you don't have to worry about, you know, getting it in an alley or, you know, some covert means.
Quality as well as possibly laced with something else.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely.
True. Yeah.
But I do want to just say that, like, you know, I'm a medical patient, and everything that you get at the dispensary isn't, you know, necessarily the greatest quality, right? Or grown the best.
How do you know that?
You said, how do you know that?
How do you know that it's not? I mean, that's just like saying that, you know, everything that you get at Target or Walmart may not be the best quality. So how do you gauge that?
Well, as a consumer, like sometimes you can have moldy cannabis, right? You might have dry cannabis.
Yeah.
You might have just cannabis that it has high THC, but it has no terpenes. So like
terpenes, help me here.
So terpenes, you know, essentially there's terpenes in everything that exists out here, right? Like pine trees have terpenes, you know, and terpenes basically tell you, describe how you might feel from consuming the cannabis.
Okay.
Right. And so I know if I want one type of feeling, like I want an uplifting feeling, I know that I'm going to do something with limonene, you know, and limonene can also be found in limes and lemons.
Okay.
And so that is what terpenes is. A lot of times when people come from the recreational market, they just want whatever has that highest THC.
Yeah.
Right? They're like, oh, you know, what's gonna hit?
So you're saying all THC is not created equal?
No.
Oh no. Jamal can tell you about that.
Not by far.
So, Delegate Wilson, as it relates to the the incarceration of those who were involved in the illegal marijuana market. Where are we with that?
And I first of all, I want to be clear. Although I'm a criminal defense attorney, I am the chair of House Economic Matters. And I say this for a reason, because we have judiciary, which is a different committee that deals with that. My job was to make sure, it's kind of like this. A lot of times in my community, they always tell us, hey, we're going to build some roads and some schools in your communities. And we shuck and jive, and we click our heels and sing, we shall overcome. And we never ask, wait a minute, who's building those roads and the billions of dollars, where are they going to? That's my job. My job was to make sure that if indeed this was going to happen, that my people were able to benefit. So obviously we have other committees that are dealing with the criminal justice side of this, making sure that individuals that were caught with possession of marijuana can get those records expunged. However, we have a larger issue, as you probably know, is the individuals that were selling marijuana that are committing felonies. So there will be an argument, and we'll get both sides, I guess, of, well, are those people, should those records be expunged? Now you ask a lot of people in the communities that I serve, they would say absolutely not, because it's not like they're just there selling drugs, and the whores that came with the drug sales are what destroyed our communities. So those people that live in my communities have no quarter for the individuals that chose to sell and create drug markets in their own communities. However, again, I'm one person, but I'm also not in charge of that. We have a whole committee for that. When it comes to that, my job was to make sure that we created a market, a legitimate market that my people could participate in, because I'm so very tired of people telling me how important marijuana is to African Americans, when what they really should be saying is how important making money, making sure we have a business model that we can succeed on, is to African Americans. Because otherwise, we get just hoodwinked again, where we pay all the money and get none of the proceeds. That's why I designed this bill this way.
202-319-7810. 202-319-7810. We are talking about the legalization of recreational marijuana in the state of Maryland. What does it mean for the state? Of course, it became legal on July 1st. We have dispensaries that have now licensed by the state, are there for the purchase of recreational marijuana. If you have a comment, if you have a question, what do you think about this? I'd like to hear what you have to say at 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. Council member, you were going to respond to what the delegate was just saying.
Well, I think the dirty truth is we didn't go as far as we should on, criminal justice reform in relation to cannabis. I understand, which committee, economic matters, but, we definitely needed to have more of an emphasis. There were a lot of bills about cannabis reform that were separate from, this package bill. But one of the things that I've been saying, long before, even on the campaign trail, and I'm sure CT can, attest to this, I was saying, no legalization without decarceration of nonviolent cannabis prisoners, right? So, yeah, I was selling an ounce 10 years ago, but did I commit a violent crime? No. Well, let that be reconsidered. Let my case be reconsidered, because on the merits, I'm a cannabis dealer just as anybody else, right? The thought is, I went to a cannabis hearing when it came to the smell, as far as probable cause being probable cause. Mm-hmm. Some of the main people testifying against it were sheriffs from Western Maryland, the Eastern Shore. Of course, it was a lot of people that look like, Jamal, myself, CT, that were championing for not having this bill. But what they saw it as a tool to continue the war on drugs. And so when we talk about breaking up the war on drugs and looking at it from a business aspect, we should decarcerate as well, especially if they were nonviolent cannabis prisoners.
If I just may ask a quick question.
Sure, go real quick, because I'm going to have to take a break in a minute, but go right ahead, Delegate.
Okay, the problem is, it must be known, it's still illegal. What we're asking to decriminalize will be New York's problem. If we make it where it's not a crime to sell on the streets, then we're never going to be able to get rid of this market. And the African Americans who are investing money into starting these businesses won't be able to compete with the guys on the street in the street corner. There still has to be a rule of law, and I don't want that being sold on my street corner. we still have to deal with the fact that it is still a crime. We're just because we're trying to make it legitimate, you, just like you can't sell liquor on the street corner, that's also a crime. You can't sell bread on the street corner. We have to recognize there is a rule of law, and these individuals violating that rule of law will still be penalized.
So let me ask you this, because we still have to talk about just the entire business aspect of this too, Jamal. I'm not ignoring you, but obviously, if during the next legislative session, if a decarceration bill, goes before, the House. Yeah, you said you were economic matters chair. I get it, but you're still a delegate. And
that's correct.
And you still have your ear to the ground. Would you vote for decarceration of those who committed crimes related to marijuana? Not violent crimes, but just the sale or possession.
Again, I think that's already been in. The sale? No. Again, decarceration, I believe we're making up a word here. I would have to see what it looked like, because if we're trying to get people records expunged after 5 years, of course, if we're saying that they've served their time and now they've been clean for 5 years, that's great. But again, if you sell weed tomorrow on a street corner and you get caught, you're committing a crime.
Now, hold that point.
It's an 18-month misdemeanor, but it's a crime.
Delegate, hold that point. I've got to take a break. Maurice from D.C., James from Laurel, we're going to be talking to you next. Stay with us. The Daily Drum will continue on Sirius XM Channel 141. I'm Harold Fisher. John Mons is next with the original Quiet Storm on WHUR. We'll be back with this conversation in just a few seconds. Welcome back to The Daily Drum on Sirius XM Channel 141. I'm Harold Fisher. We're talking about what legalization of recreational marijuana means for Marylanders. Of course, it became legal on July 1st. Just been 10 days. My guests are Jamal Waith, brand developer for Bouquet Rolling Papers, Martin Mitchell, at-large council member for the city of Laurel, Maryland, and Maryland District 28 Delegate C.T. Wilson. That's in Charles County. He's also chair of the House Economic Matters Committee. Lines are open at 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. Maurice, calling from D.C., thanks for hanging on. What's on your mind?
Not a problem. I want to give a special shout-out to the cannabis councilman. Also, I'm from D.C., and from my standpoint, I do like going into the shop and getting it. And, where it's more regulated at. And on the streets, I go out of my way not to get it from the street now, just to go in the shop. And Maryland, one thing about Maryland that Maryland can do that D.C. can't do, because it's not federally mandated, Maryland can profit off of it, and Maryland can use their profit source, different programs and stuff. So, I just like to give a special, shout out to Maryland, man, for making it legal and being able to use it, to use the profits for, different programs, and hope it goes to the community.
Maurice, thank you so much for your phone call. 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. James, calling from Laurel. Thanks for calling, James. What's on your mind?
How you doing? I own the first hemp store here in Laurel, Maryland, historic Main Street. So my question is, do you think Maryland Senate is being fair by wanting to strip us of selling all of our deltas that were hemp derived?
Okay, help me with that. What, say that again, James. James, can you hear me? Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay. You hit me with something I don't, and I'm sure a lot of our listeners don't understand. You said stripping you of delta. What is that? What does that mean? Break it down for me.
Delta 8, Delta 9. Delta 9 is the delta that we all grew up known as marijuana.
Okay.
In 2018, when the Farm Bill passed to grow legal hemp, scientists took legal hemp, processed it, turned it into oils and other variables, and created a higher THC level, but it's still hemp derived. It's not regular marijuana. 4.5 years later, Maryland Senate wants to strip us from selling that and let the cannabis culture monopolize and sell everything hemp derived and marijuana derived. Mm. Do you think that's fair?
I'll ask the delegate. I mean, I know you're on the other, you know, on the other side. But are you familiar with what James is referring to?
Very much so. And to be very clear, he is not being stripped. He, too, can get a license to sell because that's what wasn't happening before. That was an unregulated market, not even inspected. Much of that, much of the hemp was from out of state, out of country. The goal is to have safe. If you're going to sell an intoxicant in my state, you need a license, and it needs to be inspected. These individuals that own these hemp stores can also now get a license for marijuana to sell cannabis, but they can't sell unregulated hemp anymore. We have taken that out. We want this to be a healthy market. That's how you get a healthy market, by regulating.
Okay. James, thank you. Go ahead, real quick.
So my response to that is, when you pass the Farm Bill in 2018, everything is third-party tested, so there is no unsafe hemp. They have North Carolina hemp, Oregon hemp. They have hemp grown everywhere, okay? This is not regular marijuana. This doesn't even get you high. So my older customers are kind of perturbed that you all are making them go to the dispensary. Yes, I can apply for a license, but I have to wait till September. And then once that happens, once I submit it, it won't be granted probably till January 2024. And it's a lottery. So I've been in business 4.5 years. So that means you want to strip me from something that was federally legal. Everything I have is third-party tested. Everything has paperwork. It's not from the gas stations. It's not from the corner store. It's all legitimate bought material.
Delegate, real quick.
Real quick, is that might be how his is done, but that's not how all the business doing. Roughly 80% of the stuff was coming from out of state, much of it coming out of country. Just because he did it right, that doesn't mean it was being done right. And at the end of the day, the safety of our constituents is the utmost. And it's not all being tested. It's being tested maybe by some, but not all of it's being tested. We did the research, and we realized, and it's being sold as an intoxicant. That's the problem. It's not being sold for a cream and the way they pitched it. Most of us would have never voted for that to be legal, because we voted it in Maryland the same way if we thought they were selling hemp for anything else but making, I don't know, shoes and clothing. We were not aware that they were selling it and creating a hemp product or a consumable with it.
Mm. James, thank you so much for your phone call. It looks like we may be hearing from James again, perhaps in a public hearing during the next legislative session. 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. We are talking about recreational marijuana, legal, in the state of Maryland. Where are we? What do you think? Is it a good thing? Is it a bad thing? We're talking about both and everything in between. Okay, Jamal. let's put aside politics for just a moment and just talk about the business aspect. And you know, with bouquet rolling papers, you don't have a marijuana dispensary. You're working for a company that deals with rolling papers. How has the legalization in Maryland impacted the business? Kind of give me the quick chronology, because I know we were talking before the program that you didn't see a jump on July 1st. You all were like most businesses, preparing for the change.
Yeah, I think for us, it was just, how did we need to pivot for the legalization, because we knew it was coming. We just didn't know how big it was really going to be. So that entailed going, just trying to strategically hit different places on that day, just our marketing, who we were, dealing with, who we were trying to reach, all types of things of that nature. So I think for us, it wasn't, because like I said, we are ancillary business, so we don't necessarily touch the plant, but we are fully involved in it as well. So it was just how do we see the market affecting us, and where we needed to be at the time.
Talk to me about your observations also, because obviously with the legalization, we do know that there are some people who are coming out of the shadows with this.
Yeah, I think the biggest thing is you don't know who those people are. You because everyone smokes. That's the biggest
thing. Well, not everybody.
Not everyone, but the majority of people. Like, there's a lot of people that, I'll say this then. There's a lot of people that you come in contact with and that you know, but you have no clue because those people have been closet smokers and closet users, closet patients, closet whatever you want to call it, of cannabis for a very long time. And this kind of gives them a way to step out of those, you know, step out of the shadow. And also, like, I am totally about the tested market. So, you know, not get that street weed and stuff like that. So I think those are big things for the average Marylander that they might not have had at one point in time.
Mm-hmm. So, I mean, again, it's like, you know, instead of, you know, Ray Ray on the corner in the alley, and, you know, now you can go to the shopping center.
And I saw that Saturday. I mean, and I saw that Saturday, and I saw it Sunday. I saw it all weekend. People that normally would not have come to a dispensary. I feel like the medical patient in Maryland is a lot of, has a lot of faces. One is a face of, this is, gives me safety. So if I am stopped or if something, I have something to say, hey, I am a medical patient, this is why I have this. But this now, it frees people up a little bit. So it's, you know, of course, I feel like I said, you know, having a half an ounce of weed or something on you is an absorbent amount of weed to have at some one point in time. Like, I, you know, straight up and down, like, for the person that knows, like, you know, there's people that doesn't know, but like the delegate just chuckled. Martin will look at me and laugh at the same thing. To have that amount on you at one point in time is a lot, right? And you're like, you going from A to B is one thing, but just to just stand out on the street with this amount is a lot of weed.
You should have always been able to, you know, have that amount. Prohibition should have never happened.
You. Well, you know, and that's what I'm going to ask you, you know, council member. So, you know, for you personally, what did July 1st mean for you as a medical cannabis user?
As a medical cannabis user, you know, for me, it meant more people coming around to being open to use cannabis. And you know, I think with legalization, we will see more research. So that's going to be key because, you know, we've been trying to say how great of a medicine it was and, you know, how many ailments it could cure and help. And so that's what it meant for me, furthering research. But, you know, to Jamal's point, you did see a bunch of different, you know, consumers. One of the things that I realized in the medical market, a lot of times I saw a lot of 30 plus, you know, and so because there were some barriers, of course, going and getting your license. And then, of course, you could still get it on the street at that point. And so now you'll see a lot more people, a lot of those, you know, some of those street dudes that might have never thought about obtaining a license. You mm-hmm. know, you now see in line at the dispensary. And so, you know, I appreciate those closet users, as he calls them, and those closet users. You never really know what they look like, right?
You don't.
And so that's kind of the interesting part. And everyone has a different story on why they consume, why they use. Mm-hmm. And I did want to give big props to James. You know, he's from my city, mm-hmm. James. You know, I've known him for several years as a business owner.
The caller. Yeah.
Yes. And you know, I will attest to. One of the things that the delegate said is you do have some bad business owners who were bad actors. And there were a lot of CBD, you know, sold at gas stations. There was a lot of them sold at smoke shops. But I can say that, you know, James, he actually invested in a brick and mortar store 4 years ago. A lot of people thought that, you know, it was going to fail. A lot of people had no idea, you know, who was going to come to that store. Right. And one of the things that I've seen over the years is a lot of people who went to his store were, you know, older white adults. That was kind of his main consumer base. And a lot of them, the reason that it was they were open to it is because CBD, you know, wasn't as scary to them as THC because of the, you know, not psychoactive effects. When we're talking about the Delta 8 and the Delta 9, those are synthetic. And so that's a little bit different. That's extracted out of the plant and then, you know, put back in. But so that's a little bit different. So, you know, I will say, James, keep pushing. you know, hopefully we can make sure that, you know, his business continues and, you know, other good CBD businesses, like I mentioned, hopefully in the future we could have cottage business licenses. We do have micro, but hopefully we can have some cottage business ones for, you know, Sturbel Treats and other. That means that basically you can grow at home, you can get your products tested and sell it on the market. That's essentially what that means.
You mean like it's just like baking cakes?
Yeah, I mean, at the
end
of the
day, kitchen?
If we're talking about respecting the legacy market is the one that's fueled the cannabis business, right? The legacy market is the one that's kept cannabis going, right? And so, but at the end of the day, you know, who is going to profit? You know, there's going to be some minority owners. There's going to be some people who weren't in the industry. But at the end of the day, the true legacy market, you know, the people who, you know, the Ray Rays, you know, that's the true legacy market that I'm thinking about.
I want to talk a little bit more about that, but let me go back to the phone lines first. 202-319-7810. 202-319-7810. Eric, calling from Arizona. Eric, thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
Yeah, I have a question based on the funding that's going to be generated as far as the taxable income. Has the legislature talked about where they're actually going to place that money? How are they going to be transparent and pushing that money to social programs as opposed to putting it anywhere else? I think that's something that maybe should be considered.
Delegate Wilson?
Roughly, the way I set it up, and again, I drafted this bill. It took about 8.5 months to get this right. We have 35% of this going to the Community Reinvestment Repair Fund for the next 10 fiscal years. It's for community grants. Each of the counties is going to be able to apply for these grants. 5% of it's going to go to cannabis public health because obviously there's some issues we have to do with the psychoanalysis, making sure the individuals aren't getting sick, making sure it's been properly tested. 5% is going to go to the cannabis business fund, which is how we reinvest in all these individuals. We've set aside roughly $80 million for these minority investors to get some backing in grants and loans. And that's how we're going to keep replenishing that fund. In addition, 5% is going to go to counties. So that's how we've broken this down. And as far as getting the money back out into communities, the individual communities will be responsible for anything from Boys and Girls Clubs, things of that nature, for applying and, you know, demonstrating and making sure they're shovel ready. Because what we're not going to do is just have monies going out and sitting around. So we want to make sure these are basically shovel ready projects in the communities that were disproportionately impacted by the war on drugs or of low income communities. It's very specific.
Eric, thank you.
I salute you, sir, on putting that money back into youth programs. Thank you very much.
Eric, thank you so much for your phone call. 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. Let me ask you, Delegate, and I mentioned this at the top of the program, this next round of licenses is supposed to prioritize minority ownership. Can you, in layman's terms and briefly, explain how that is going to work?
Yeah, and because of the makeup of our Supreme Court, I would beg you to never say those words again. We are not targeting minorities because, you know, we won't get anything that way. We are targeting individuals that have been disproportionately affected by the war on drugs.
Oh, you mean black folks?
Color,
can I say
no,
black folks?
You can, but I can't.
Okay, well, it's my show, so I'll say minorities, black folks, yeah, folks that know, look like you and me.
And I'm joking when I say that.
I know that. We can worry. go ahead. I mean, you have curly hair and I have none, but we all are the same. Go right ahead, Delegate.
Yeah, but the way we did it, since we couldn't use color, mind you, I will say that I did set aside 5 growing licenses specifically for the individuals, the black farmers, the relatives and the survivors of the black farmers. As you know, for 100 years, the USDA denied African Americans relief and for disaster relief. And we lost 99% of all of our black farmers. So now we have the relatives of these black farmers. We have 160 of them in Maryland. 5 of them will be able to get licenses to grow, and they'll be able to grow on their own size. We additionally set it out, since we couldn't use color, we identified communities that had 150% or higher arrest rate for cannabis possession. Now, coincidentally, they don't all look like us, but a lot of them do look like us. There are a few white communities in Western Maryland that have the same issue. Well, you have to have either lived there for 5 of the last 10 years, you had to go on to public school there for at least 5 years, or you had to go to a school that took in more than 40% Pell Grants for college, because we couldn't use color, because you know it had to be race neutral, and this is how we set aside. If we're not able to get a proper representation of Marylanders via this process, we can then go race specific.
You know, I wanted to ask you about this, Jamal. You're, you know, as a business person, you're well traveled. You know the lay of the land as it relates to cannabis and cannabis affiliated businesses. And I was in Seattle 2 years ago, and the cannabis business in Seattle is explosive.
Right.
To the point where you have to really pay attention to the restaurants that you go into, because you may have on one corner a restaurant, period. But on the same block, you may have a restaurant that serves cannabis-infused everything.
Mm-hmm.
And I found it to be particularly fascinating. And while Seattle is not does not have the kind of African American population that we have here in the DMV, but I would argue that in this space, whether it is in Washington State or Colorado, and now even in Maryland, there are very, very few dispensaries where people look like us, medical or otherwise.
Mm-hmm.
How difficult is it for someone to open up a business? If I said I wanted to open up Harold's Edible and Smoke Shop and apply for a license, what do I need?
To be 1,000% transparent, I applied initially for a growers, processors, and a dispensary license in the state of Maryland, and I didn't even hear back from it, so I know I got denied. Out of the, I would say, 20 people that I know of none who had gotten that license.
Who were not already established as medical.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, you know, that is the question again, semantics notwithstanding, Delegate, that it seems that, you know, once again, and we saw this in Colorado, where it was illegal, boom, no people of color.
And again, to be very clear, less than 2% of the entire nation's cannabis market industry are minorities.
That's exactly. That's my point. Yeah.
So to your point, I guess you're asking a deeper question, because I just explained how you're not going to be able to apply if you didn't live in those areas. You're not going to be able to apply for these social equity licenses. But to your greater point, I'm sure the young man will agree, it's not just about having a license if you can't get the business up and running, correct?
This is true.
So we've also, because luckily economic matters regulate the banking industry, and we've set something up with our local, with our Maryland banks and our credit unions, we're doing loan loss prevention up to $500,000 for a dispensary, up to $1 million loan for a grower processor that these individuals will be able to access once these equity licenses are given out, in addition to the grants that I discussed before, making sure these individuals, and they'll also be able to go to our colleges to get tax information, to get backing, because it's not enough to give a minority business owner a license. They have to be able to be successful. As you know, one of every three licenses or businesses fail in the first 3 years. So in order to do that, we have to set aside not only money, but education, and make sure that our Office of Social Equity is following these guys along, making sure that their license is moving forward, making sure they're getting the access, making sure, and here's a big one, that these established markets are dealing with them. Because the last thing you want is a dispensary that can't get any cannabis, because the ones that are owning, let's be honest, I think all the growers except for maybe one out of the 18 medical growers that have transferred over are minority. And so, are white. So what you have is, we need to make sure that that good old boy network is broken up. To make sure, and we did that, making sure they have to do business with these new business owners, making sure they have to make sure there's shelf space for our minority growers and our minority processors.
Real quick,
you're correct.
Mariah, calling from Virginia. Thanks for calling, Mariah. What's on your mind?
Hi, I'm calling because I do have property to grow, and I also would like to find out
who on your panel that I can contact about getting a license and preparing? I do have the money to get the licensing, but as I just heard, a part of my question was answered. And it's not only just because of my being a minority, but about the being able to get into that club, or I can't say it's a club, but being able to get in there where I won't be denied. And who do I contact? Because I heard someone talking about grants and having, I guess, the right people, contacts, in order for you to get a license. I'm just starting out, and I need information from your panel. Who do I contact?
Now, first of all, you're in Virginia, correct?
No, I have property in Virginia, and we've started to, as a family, to grow hemp in Virginia. Once the 2018, from Virginia, but I live in Maryland.
Oh, so you live in?
I reside in Maryland.
Okay, right. So here's my question: are you asking who do you talk to start a business in Maryland or Virginia?
In Maryland, where I live.
Because I was about to say,
I do have several acres in Virginia, where we, once 2018, when they passed the bill, we were going to just grow hemp.
Right. Well, and as you probably know, legalized sales in Virginia of recreational marijuana is scheduled for January 1st of 2024. And
I know.
And for those in Virginia or listening in Virginia, for those who have questions about that, you probably need to reach out to our Virginia's Cannabis Control Authority. However, for your Maryland question, I will defer to Delegate Wilson. Delegate Wilson.
The Maryland Cannabis Administration is who you'd reach out to. We have a website. It's executive branch, obviously. It's not me. Maryland Cannabis Administration have a website. They're showing you when the breakouts are, when the different licenses, when the applications, how to apply. They have the Office of Social Equity within Maryland Cannabis Administration that's going to help you and guide you. But and I will say lastly that, as you know, transporting any kind of cannabis over cross state lines is still illegal, even if it's legal in Virginia. So please don't make that mistake.
And to that point, which is where I was going next, and Mariah, I hope that answered your question. And thank you so much for your phone call. Let's really be very, very clear about this, Council Member Mitchell. While it may be recreational marijuana is legal in Maryland, it is still not federally legal. And just because it is statewide legal in Maryland, there are still occupations that you have, for example, in the state of Maryland, where you can't use. I mean,
very correct.
You know, sure. I mean, you know, sure. you're a council member for the city of Laurel, but police officers, you know, obviously they can't use. There are other jobs.
Well, maybe we should look at, you know, especially off duty, like New York, New Jersey.
And so here's my question about that. I use police officers, but again, this is not just about police officers. We have a lot of federal government employees. There are other, you know, private companies that have random drug tests, and that's a reality.
Yes. I mean, that's true. I mean, one of the things that we have to do is, you know, change these employment policies. Like, even at the city of Laurel, you know, prior to, of course, this law passing, I know we're going to discuss it as a council and everything. Prior to this law passing, you know, it was frowned upon to be a medical patient and, you know, be an admin, you know, so it's not even just, you know, the police department that, you know, would catch hellfire for it, even administrative positions. But, you know, that's why I said, you know, the thought is just looking at it further, because a lot of the police officers, they're going through trauma. You know, they have ailments and, you know, probably sore aches. And if it was, you know, legal statewide, of course, for them to do it, or locally, or even federally, they would probably use cannabis to some way, some form. You know, one of the great things that I've been able to do is go around the city and tell senior citizens about CBD and educate them on what CBD might be, right? And so, you know, of course, you don't want people using on the job when they're using heavy machinery, right? And so that's why I said off of duty, and you know, maybe we should look.
But when something struck me when you said off duty, let's go back to the police officer. Police officers at any given time can be on duty, because you can be off duty and sitting around getting it in with your boys, and then all of a sudden
very true. You could also be at a bar.
You can be anywhere where it's legal, yes. And then something pops off, and then you have to put your badge on.
I can't go back to work, boss. I was just at the bar drinking.
Exactly.
The same way I was just consuming cannabis.
That's my point. So I think I can't
go back to work.
It is a complex question.
It's complex, but what we talk about is opioid reduction, right? So a lot of those police officers, ask them how many are prescribed opioids. Tons of them prescribed opioids for the knee problems, the back problems. It's a very physical job, right? It's a huge mental stress. So what we have seen in states that have, you know, medical cannabis and legalization, we've seen a decrease in opioid usage. And so that's why we should have this conversation more, because as we know, fentanyl, opioid abuse, it kills and it's deadly, right? And so that's why I say at least having the conversation.
And we will continue to have this conversation as well. Lots to talk about. I want to thank all of you, Jamal Waithe, Councilmember Martin Mitchell, and Delegate C.T. Wilson for having this conversation. It's important. It doesn't stop here, and we will keep our eye on it. Thank you all so much.
I appreciate you.
Sure thing. That is the Daily Drum for this Monday, July 10th. I'm Harold Fisher.